or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Robert Cialdini is the author of a truly classic book on influencing people, pithily titled Influence. It's crucial in politics. Indeed, Cialdini was a key member of President Obama's obviously highly successful messaging team. And because I hear his six key principles frequently used by many, many leading Democrats, I'm assuming he's been involved there as well. But those six principles are equally applicable to the core focus of this show's focus, people's work life. So, Bob Cialdini, welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Well, thank you, Marty. Glad to be with you and your audience.
Thank you. Let's look at those six principles and let's see how they might be applied to one's work life. The first one is called reciprocity. You do something for someone, they feel obligated. Like a nonprofit has sent me, I just recently got a calendar from one. I got an actual shiny dime from another. Makes you feel, maybe at least their attempt is to make you feel obligated to donate 100 times that much. Now, I know people, though, who have complained they have given and given forever in their work life, personal life, etc. They've followed the networking rule of give before you can expect to get, and yet it seems no one reciprocates. They're still unemployed a year later, and they're getting ever closer to having to eat cat food. What would you say to him or her?
I'd say, it's not always the case that when you say thank you to somebody that's works in a way that you wished, or when you apologize to somebody, that always works. So that doesn't mean we should stop saying thank you or stop giving genuine apologies when they're appropriate. In the same way, we shouldn't stop giving first because it hasn't always worked. But I would add that there are ways to increase the likelihood that what you give first will work to spur people to give back to you in the fullest measure. And what the research shows is that there are three factors that dramatically influence the probability that if you give to someone, that person will not only stand ready to give back to you when you need it, will stand eager to do so.
I'm all ears. Go for it.
The first is that what you give has to be meaningful to that person. The second is that it has to be personalized to that individual. And finally, it needs to be offered in a way that's unexpected, isn't just part of what we all do anyway, right? So if somebody asks you for the time of day and you give it to them, that's not a big deal. That's just something that would happen to anybody. You do that as a matter of course. But if you can give first something that's meaningful, something that's unexpected, and personalized, customized to that person's needs at the moment, you optimize the likelihood of return.
Can you give a workplace-specific or career-specific example of that?
Let's take an example of restaurants where we've all been, and waiters. I don't know how many of your audience members have ever served as a waiter or waitress in a restaurant, but what's important for them is tips because they don't pay very much in a restaurant. Turns out that if the server does something at the end of the meal that it fits completely with the rule of reciprocity, right, they will increase their tips significantly. That simple thing is when the server comes with the bill on a tray to have a mint or a chocolate on the tray for each diner. And if they do that, it increases their tips by 3.3%.
I love the concept. Let me see if I can apply it even more potently. So if I'm that waiter, you know, mints are not that unexpected, and
right,
a piece of chocolate is not that unexpected. But what if I happen to have overheard in the conversation that one of them is about to, they particularly loved the potatoes au gratin.
Right.
And I went back to the chef and I said, would you mind if you would give the recipe for that? And I put that recipe down. Now, I won't be able to do that. But if I put that recipe down with the check, now I'm going to get a big tip. Is that?
That's a bullseye insight, because that would be not only meaningful, it would be unexpected, and it would be personalized. Now, let me finish that study, and I will reinforce exactly what you said. In this study, they did another condition in which the waiter came to the table, in this time with something unexpected. Two mints on the tray for each diner.
Oh, there was more to the study. I didn't know that. Go ahead. Uh-huh.
And now tips went up 14%.
Wow.
Now, third condition in this study. I love this study. All right. This time, the waiter comes to the table with one mint on the tray for each diner, turns to walk away, stops himself, and returns, and says, you know what? For you, nice people.
Ooh.
And puts the second mint down in front of each diner.
Oh, my God.
And tips go through the roof.
Brilliant.
20% increase over the normal tip.
Brilliant. My attempt for parsimony would combine the three factors to two. Meaningful and personalized are really one, because it's if it's meaningful to that person. So I would say it's got to be meaningful to that person and unexpected. Those two things, meaningful to the person and unexpected, that is a lovely formulation for the way to maximize the likelihood that your first principle, reciprocity, will indeed be reciprocated.
Right. And so the fact that some people have said to you, you know, I've tried to give in the past and I don't always get in return, my response is, how have you given? Have you fumbled the ball with the factors that urge people, require people to give back to you if what you've given has been meaningful, unexpected, and personalized?
You've put a smile on my face. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Bob Cialdini. He is the author of the classic book on influencing people called Influence, and a key member of President Obama's obviously highly successful messaging team. We can already start to see why. Let's turn to your second of your six core principles for how to influence people, whether it be in the workplace, in the marketplace, or in politics. Commitment and consistency. Once you've expressed support for a product or an idea, you say, I believe in that, I agree with that, or you've given a few bucks, you tend to keep that commitment. That's why nonprofits, for example, universities, where I've spent a lot of time, start by asking for the smallest support. It could be a yes-no vote on the new logo for some part of the university's School of Education, or a few bucks, even though the university loses money when they're pitching for that. It costs money to go pitch.
Right.
The goal of the university is to get you committed to the university, so sooner or later, you give them the big bucks. For example, you make the college a beneficiary in your will. What's another example, Bob, of how that commitment and consistency principle can you be used in your career or in the workplace?
Okay, let's go back to the restaurant, and then I'll suggest something broader than that.
Okay.
But this time, a problem not faced by servers, but by restaurateurs, by managers, owners. And it's no-shows.
Right.
People who call, book a table, and then they just don't appear.
Right.
They don't call ahead to cancel, nothing. They just don't show up. Big problem. There's a guy in Chicago named Gordon Sinclair.
Okay.
Gordon's Restaurant, who's figured out a way to reduce significantly the portion of no-shows at his restaurant by having his receptionist add two words to what she says when she takes a reservation.
Wow.
Previously, she said, please call if you have to cancel or change your reservation. You probably heard that a million times.
Right.
Gordon, who is a student of the influence process, has instructed her to say, will you please call if you have to change and cancel your reservation? And then he instructs her to pause.
Got it. Wow. So they're making the commitment. They're saying yes.
And that's, of course I will. Sure. Glad to. Yeah.
I love it.
And that's the commitment.
Brilliant.
No shows at Gordon's Restaurant dropped from 30% to 10% immediately.
Potent, potent, potent.
With one more breath. Marty, he didn't have to spend a cent.
Love it to death. Love it. You know what? You know what's really going through my head as I'm listening to this? You know, we spend so much time in high school and college classes teaching arcana that no one ever needs to know. The art of influence should be the fourth R, if there were. It should be the three R's and I for influencing. This is gold. I think if every one of us learned this in junior high school, we would be so much more self-efficacious. Do you agree? Or you think I'm overhyping you?
No, I agree completely. I've lent my career to this.
Right. It's great stuff.
It's so important. But let me suggest one broader implication of commitment and consistency that we can use to advance on the job or to advance to a newer job if we wish, or to a job when we don't have one. Let's say we submit our materials and we are asked to come in for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What do we typically do at the outset of that interview? Right? We typically say, I'm happy to answer any questions you would like to have. I'm very pleased that you invited me, and I'm happy to give you all the information you would like. Right?
Right.
We should do that. Here's what I'm going to recommend that we say in addition.
Okay.
But, you know, before we begin, I have a question I wonder that I'm curious about. Can you tell me why you invited me here?
Ooh, is that good? Oh, man, it reinforces their commitment. It reinforces them to recite and
you all the reasons in your resume that fit with their organization.
Oh, man, and of course that establishes a commitment to you.
It establishes a commitment. And here's what I've heard people say when I've given this suggestion and they come back to me. They say, it was amazing.
Yep.
The rest of the interview was spent these people validating what they just committed themselves to.
Exactly.
In my presence.
What's scary is how easy it is and how potent and not obvious. You know, because Bob, I've been doing this show 24 years, and frankly, in this whole area of career and workplace, the stuff begins to reduce to common sense and it's redundant. What you're telling me now is eye-opening. I read your book a long time ago, but I didn't think of all this stuff. My dear listeners, you know, I know you listen to a lot of radio, you read a lot of stuff. We have data smog. This is good stuff. I would urge you actually to take notes. And you never, if you're a regular listener to this show, you know I never tell you to do this. I'm really always the cynical guy who always asking the hard-probing questions, saying why. This guy is right. And this guy is, you know, he's been doing this for a lifetime, and he is potent enough that President Obama and the Democratic Party, I'm believing, am I right, you know, has used you in their messaging and influencing. It's gold, guys. You're getting it. Take notes. All right. So do you want to go a little more broadly? I mean, is there one more example of this, or should we move to your third?
Yeah, there's one more example. We get to use this on ourselves, not just on other people.
Huh.
If we want to commit ourselves to an end state, a product, an achievement, a goal, we need to do more than just make that commitment to ourselves. We've got to make it public.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, so if we've got a goal for achieving some end, it's not enough to treat it like one of these New Year's resolutions that, you know, we make to ourselves and then break. Let me give you an example. I actually love this one so much I put it in my book. The CEO of Subway Restaurants, the guy named Fred DeLuca, back in the late 1990s, he put on every one of the napkins in his restaurants, right, he said, 10,000 stores by 2001. It was big jump from where he was then.
Mm-hmm.
And a journalist asked him, why did you do this? His answer was, if I put my goals down in writing and make them known to the world, then I've committed myself to achieving them. Well, by 2001,
right,
he's got he had exceeded that by 50%.
Public commitment. That is something that is a pretty popular axiom of career counseling, but it has found a new expression in online apps. If your resolution is to lose weight or to get a job, there are apps that will, you can list all your friends and it will let them know not only of your commitment to it, but your ongoing your progress so that if you've lost a pound or gained a pound, as I have since the New Year's despite my resolution, every one of your friends knows about it. One other little expansion of that. I started a year and a half ago something I call my board of advisors. I identified the a dozen people in this world whom I most respect for their intellect, their ethics, and that they are good in a group.
Right.
And we meet and attend a teleconference. Six of the 12 accepted my invitation, and six of us meet once a month, and we publicly commit to whatever it is we're working on and get their input, and it has been very potent for all of us. So, yes, commitment and consistency, very important.
Great example.
Yeah. Let's go to your third of your six principles, Bob Cialdini's Principles of Influence. The book is called Influence, and that's social proof. I first heard of this concept of social proof when I was a boy, called the bandwagon technique. My science teacher, Mr. Baum, it's one of the few things I remember from junior high school. My science teacher told us these various ways to influence people. One was called the bandwagon technique. We're more likely to do something if we hear that others are doing it, especially people similar to us. That's why we're more likely to work late if others on our work team are doing the same. That's why commercials often use people from the target market instead of celebrities. Like, for example, GM uses blue-collar guys to tout Chevy trucks. Now, you wrote an article in which you said you use that social proof principle in getting hotel patrons to reuse their towels and sheets. Tell us about that.
I live in the Phoenix, Arizona area. We went to three hotels here, one a two-star, a three-star, and a four-star hotel. And you know, if you travel at all, that about 65-70% of the hotel guest rooms where you stay has a card in it asking you to reuse your towels and linens.
Right.
And they ask you to do it to save the environment,
right,
to save resources, to save the planet. We know they want us to save something else.
Money for the company.
Yes.
Right.
So we were wondering, well, is there anything that we could suggest that they might do to more effectively do this than just asking us to save the planet? Because a lot of us don't believe them.
Right.
Right? That's what they're really about.
Right.
So we went to these hotels and randomly interchanged with their standard appeal, do this for the environment, another sign. Right? It was a similar sign, except that it said, in addition, right, please do this, reuse your towels, it said, the majority of guests who stay in our hotel do reuse their towels at least once during their stay.
Right.
And it was true. Right? We got a 29% increase.
Makes sense. Because nobody wants to be embarrassed. They don't want to feel they're inferior. It's like when I drive by and I see, that's why like public utilities will, or like the subway will clean up graffiti right away, because if it's up there and stays up there, it's assumed that's the social norm. So the next person is going to want to put more graffiti. Go ahead.
Now, to the point that you were making earlier, we had another condition, another sign. This one didn't say the majority of guests who stayed in our hotel last year reused their towels. It said the majority of the guests who stayed in this room.
That's amazing. I love it. I love it.
And we get another
significant
increase.
Sure.
It's what are people like me doing? That's how I get my information about what's appropriate for me in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Can you analogize that to something that is in the more? Let's look. Let's say you were visiting me in my work. I'm thinking of the prototypical person who listens to NPR, and it's going to be somebody who's working for a nonprofit or a government agency, and they're in the middle somewhere. They're a professional, but they're not on the top and they're not on the bottom, and they go in and work every day. They maybe have quite a bit of job security if they're working for the government, but this notion of social proof is very potent there as well as anywhere else. Can you possibly come up with an example of how the principle of social proof might be applied to that prototypical listener to the show?
Well, I mean, toward what end? I mean,
let's say everybody is always trying to influence others, whether it's in a meeting, you're trying to get your point to others to buy in, you're trying to not lose your job in the merger, you're trying to get a promotion, that kind of stuff.
Let's say this person is a mid-level manager, There are a few people around him or her that work underneath that person. And there's a new initiative that your listener is trying to, who thinks it's very important and will increase his or her profile on the job and chances for advancement, right? But there are a couple of old-timers on the team who are hanging back.
Mm-hmm.
They're not willing to go with this. They're more comfortable, they're more satisfied doing the old things and the old habits, not changing anything.
And by the way, they may not need to be chronologically older. They may just be ideologically stuck.
Well, let's just say there are a couple of old-timers. They've seen these initiatives in the past, and they're just going to wait this one out.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so one typical response is to try to hammer these people with more arguments, more pressure, and a lot of time you just get kickback from them. You
more pushback, right.
Pushback, right. So here's what
kickbacks, too, sometimes, you know.
You go to one of the old-timers on your team who has adopted it, and in a team meeting you say, Phil, you feel this is a good thing, you've told me. Can you tell me why?
Mm-hmm.
And you let Phil make the point.
Great. Yep. Somebody
if it comes from somebody like those who are hanging back, they listen differently.
Right. Bingo. Makes great sense. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, I'll call him my special guest, Robert Cialdini. He's the author of the classic book on influencing people, pithily titled Influence, and it is crucial in politics. Indeed, Cialdini was a key member of President Obama's obviously highly successful messaging team, I believe, also probably in... have you done work also for other Democrats?
No.
Okay. But he's also got... his primary work right now is focused on the workplace. And in fact, he's got a website that might as well ask you to give it. Yours is called like Influencing at Work or something like that. What's your website?
Influence at Work, all one word.
Right.
.com.
And what do you do? What do you do for? If I'm working in a business, what do you do for me?
Well, we do training and consulting as well as speaking on the topic of the science of influence done ethically. How do we move people in desired directions using what we know scientifically about the factors that spur people toward change in a way that is entirely ethical and maintains our responsibility?
Love it to death. Let's turn to your fourth of your six principles for ethical influence. It's one's called liking. We are more likely to do what someone wants if we like him or her, and is, as you were saying earlier, in the context of the social proof principle, is similar to us. For example, somebody who is from a similar socioeconomic or ethnic background. But does that not conflict with today's workplace mantra that we need a very diverse workforce? I mean, isn't it more likely that the more similar employees are to each other, the more likely they are to cooperate with each other?
Yes, and this is really a good point that you're making, Marty. And fortunately, the research shows that characteristics like racial or ethnic or gender identity aren't as important as value similarity. The thing we really resonate to and the kind of person we want to cooperate with is the person whose values we share and who shares our values. So what this requires is that we put together on our teams and we bring into our organizations through recruitment and selection strategies people who fit the organizational culture and mission statement. Very often we bring people in based on skills and experience. Well, skills can be trained. Experience can be generated
Absolutely.
For people, but not values.
Right.
Values are set.
Doesn't that have a huge potential negative side effect in certain contexts? For example, Let's take universities that both you and I have had a lot of experience with. There is, frankly, a litmus test at almost all universities, especially in the social sciences and the humanities, that you must have a redistributive justice liberal point of view about the world, a foundational value. And therefore, indeed, when they comes time to hiring, especially giving tenure, it is going to be monolithically a very limited worldview. The worldview starts from center and moves left from there, whereas the ostensible purpose of higher education is to expose students to the full marketplace of ideas. Isn't there a danger not only in universities but in corporations? If you have some people who are similar in values, they're very bean counter oriented, they're very quantitative, their values are you need to have data, give me quantitative evidence before we move forward. And if we hire only those guys in a corporation, and women of course, as opposed to some people who do use a more subjective qualitative feeling, don't we really run a tremendous risk? Shouldn't we really have diversity of values? But won't that cause more dissension?
Well, I think it has to. I think that's right. If we do that without a focus on what the industry we're in or the organization we're in, you know, what its purposes are. So the values, for example, in a university, should be for freedom of expression, for, indeed, diversity of points of view,
right,
for freedom to research whatever topics are. Those are the values that are central to the ends and purposes of the organization that should be the ones that we prioritize. Other kinds of values, like the ones you're talking about, liberal versus conservative political standpoint, those should not be the ones along which we make our determinations.
I would argue the following. I'm curious whether you agree or disagree. If I was running, let's say, your generic company, it's a widget company, it doesn't matter, I would really make a point of focusing on ideological diversity, that is foundational values principles, as I was saying earlier. I would want some real bean counter types whose decision-making process is always grounded in quantitative empirical evidence. I would want others who are very much more subjective and believe that relying too much, that it's reductionistic to rely exclusively on data. I want to have some people who are, well, you get the point. I want that diversity and accept that it's going to be more difficult to get decisions made there. But I would rather accept the price of working through that dissension than the larger price of having a bunch of, you know, kindred spirits who are all saying, you know, we agree, amen.
Well, I agree. And as long as those opinions are facilitative of the ultimate goal of the organization, then, you know, bean counting and blue sky thinking, they're all associated with trying to do well for the organization, then we should have that diversity.
Okay, now I'm going to use one of your techniques on you, commitment bias. You had asked that we limit this interview to 20 to 30 minutes. I'm aware of the clock. It's 28 minutes. We still have two more of your six principles, and I would love to go to the phones and invite our listeners to give a call or two. May I ask your commitment to stay on a bit longer?
Yeah, sure. I'm enjoying the exchange.
Great, me too, very much so. But I will let our listeners know. I will invite you to call. If you would like the privilege, frankly, of asking a question of Robert Cialdini, who is the author of the classic book on influencing people. He was profoundly important in President Obama's reelection, and I would bet anything, he is profoundly potent in helping anybody in the workplace or workplaces. You've got your shot now to ask him a question. We're only going to take a couple of calls because I do want to respect his time. But if you would like to ask him a question, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's now turn to your fifth, while we're waiting for the calls to come in, and they are really coming in already, but let's get your fifth of your six core principles of influencing. Despite the bumper sticker that tells us to question authority, indeed it urges us to, many of us defer to authority. Clearly, being the boss helps you establish authority, but how do you establish authority if you're just a plain old worker bee?
Yeah, I think the key is to distinguish between two meanings of the term authority as it applies in the workplace. One is to be in authority, and if you're a worker bee, maybe you're not. The other is to be an authority on the topic at hand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I work as a worker bee, you can be.
Mm-hmm. The go-to
That's
guy or go-to girl. Yeah.
Authority that we can enhance, yep. And then allow others to come to us with questions or attempts for assistance that we can provide if we have made clear what our credentials are on the topic.
What
we have to do is arrange for people around us to know how we have been credentialed in the past on the topic at hand, and then we can make a contribution, we can be successful and acknowledged as such.
Of course, credential doesn't need to be a formal piece of paper. For, you know, it has been long said that, I mean, for example, in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, that it takes 10 to 20,000 hours to become an expert at something, and one can become an expert at something without any pieces of paper.
Right.
And it doesn't have to take 10 to 20,000 hours either. Let's say it was something, you know, in your workplace, it's very important to become an expert in, customer relation management software. You can be doing that on your own with just a bunch, probably a week of good study about what are the pros and cons of the different ones, of Salesforce versus the rest of them, and then just letting it be known subtly, quietly, that, oh, yeah, well, I spent the last couple of weeks looking at the pros and cons of these software, and suddenly you are credentialed, and you become the go-to guy and girl, even if you are the lowest-level worker bee.
Right, and this a follow-up to that as well is if you're really going to be effective in the workplace, you also have to be aware of the strengths and credentials of your teammates.
Mm-hmm.
And when you introduce them to somebody who doesn't know them, you have to credentialize them properly.
Great.
And when you do, you've now helped everyone along, including yourself, because of the rule for reciprocity.
Right. And
that person's going to stand ready to credentialize you.
Exactly, because they have more credibility in the space, and they're now not going to, instead of feeling defensive, that you are now challenging their hegemony in that, you know, in as the expert in that space, by acknowledging them up front, they, in the typical way in which we tend to be polite, will know that will likely credential you. It's a brilliant point. I love it to death. And, of course, as I would have predicted, all our lines are lighted up, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with Robert Cialdini. What is your question for him?
Hello?
Hi, it's you.
Is it me?
Yes.
Okay, so here's my question. I love all your principles, and I've read your book before, and I think they're very subtle and interesting, and I agree with them. But in my current situation, that rule for reciprocity, I'm in sales. I'm 100% commission right now. And what I have found is I have try to do, you know, I do a lot of research, I do certain things really well, and I kept handing them over to the guy that was training me, who was also sales. And what I found over time is that as I tried to get my foothold in this business, he was undermining me to his advantage. So finally, I took the tack of saying, look, you know, I'm 100% commission. I could walk and go somewhere else and make more money. And so I brought it, I really literally brought it up with him and with the business owner and said, you know, either you let me make a foothold here or I'm leaving. I'll either make you money or someone else. But you know, there's certain things I will not tolerate. And I completely challenged him, and it was confrontational. And now I'm going to see what's going to happen on Monday. But, I mean, I am working my butt off. I'm working 7 days a week. And this guy has got, you know, 15 years worth of legacy on the system. But, you know, he's just taking advantage of what I'm doing.
Robert, do you have any response to as you're listening to this?
Well, yeah, a couple. One is, in those cases where people just are not playing by the rules, we have to do what we always do in our culture with people who don't play by the rules, and that is to go somewhere else, to cut off contact with those kinds of people. If that's the case, if this person, now that you've made your case that there's that you've been putting in resources and effort and so on, and you expect to get something back. If this person says no, you really do have to go somewhere else. This, I mean, the rule of reciprocity is the fundamental feature of a system. And if this guy isn't going to play within the rules of the system, then You have to move on. So that's one thing to say. There's another way to get at this, and I'm going to suggest it's a completely different way. And it has to do with people who are at loggerheads within a system, who just don't get along. One thing you can do to increase the likelihood that you will get along is to use the liking principle. That is, give this person a compliment on something that he really deserves. Right? It might take a while to find that, but give him a compliment. It changes everything. You go from an antagonistic, competitive exchange to something that reorients this person to you. Because a compliment then comes back to you, or this person recognizes, oh, we're not in such a competitive environment here. There's room for us to collaborate and work together. So you might try that before just bailing out.
I think the caller hung up, but I want to amplify that point. There's a research done by a Berkeley researcher named Jennifer Chatman who found that actually flattery, there is almost no limit to how potent flattery is in increasing their fondness for you and openness to you. So it may seem transparent, but really, I'm not saying you fake the flattery,
right?
But if you provide honest, you know, there's always something good about everybody.
Right.
And if you can legitimately offer a bit of heartfelt praise, that can really open the door to there be opening to other things. Let's go back to the phones. All the lines continue to be lighted up. Let's go. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Bob Cialdini. What is your question for him?
Hi. I have a couple of questions. At first, I have a comment. The notion of reciprocity, as you describe it, is very obscure to me. When I go to a restaurant and somebody has responded to something that they overheard in my conversation, I am immediately appalled. I do not want people acknowledging, if they did overhear, that they overheard something. When I'm with somebody and I'm having a conversation that's entirely private and I'm having a private experience, I don't want to interact with the server in that sort of tertiary manner. Secondly, if someone brings me a mint or a candy, I just assume it's the protocol of the restaurant. It will in no way negate bad service if there has been bad service. I only tip generously when the server has genuinely lived up to his job. She or he is there to do a job, and how well she or he does it is what merits the size of the tip, not whether he, like a sycophant at the last minute, brings me candy. So I would like to have some real-world examples of, in your experience, your guest's experience, where this theory of reciprocity actually worked for him and where it failed.
Okay, and Bob,
secondly,
you want to respond? Bob?
I can tell you, I don't know if you'll appreciate or say that this is the right thing to do, but the data are very clear, for example. Even in the area of...
Excuse me, let him finish. Excuse me, caller, would you let Dr. Cialdini continue?
Yeah, medical prescriptions that doctors give to patients as to which particular drug or medicine they should use, the data are very clear that the more the drug company, the more the pharmaceutical company has given to the doctor, the more likely they are to prescribe medication from that company.
Alas.
So, yeah, that's an alas, but it's the point of, in the workplace, this is a very powerful engine of change. So if we can decide for ourselves, what can I give in this situation to the people around me that is meaningful, unexpected, and customized to their particular needs? That strikes me as something that's going to make a contribution in the workplace to those around us and will cause those people to stand ready to give back to us when we need something.
calls, all our lines are up. I want to thank you for the call. You know, certainly if in fact, I mean, this one is so common sense. I mean, the whole world centers around, you know, in business, there are thousands and thousands of business gifts. In politics, money, donations are not given for charity. They're given in especially large donations, are given an expectation of reciprocity. To argue that people don't respond to rewards, especially unexpected and personalized rewards, is, let's just be kind and say, more than counterintuitive. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Dr. Robert Cialdini. What is your question for him?
I love that tip about the interview and asking why you were invited in.
Yeah, it's great. Isn't that great?
Okay,
yeah.
Along those lines, we're told to ask for informational interviews, and I worked as a temporary employee for a large university medical center, and I'm trying to get a permanent job. So one of my normal things I do when I see something I like is to not only apply through the official brass ring thing online to apply, but also to find out who the hiring manager is and send a friendly email requesting an informational interview saying, I'm applied, I'm very interested in your department, very qualified, fits me well, think I can do good work for you. Could I come in and learn a little more about the position? I've gotten zero response. What can I do to secure that informational interview or perhaps any interview?
Robert Cialdini, what do you think?
I'm going to go to topic we were discussing earlier. Can you find somebody who can recommend you to that individual for that someone who you both know, who can credentialize you and say, you know, this is somebody who I've worked with. We had a project together. And, you know, I think he would be worth spending that time with because he has the following qualities that I witnessed.
Makes, of course, great sense, but let's make it hard. Let's say he doesn't, you know, there is this desired organization he really wants to work with, and he doesn't know anybody in the organization, and he knows that LinkedIn connections are really illusory connections. They're not substantive. And he's forced to either write something or call on the phone that would get that. Well, let's not even call it. I don't like the idea of informational interviews because it's something of a ruse because he really wants a job. He doesn't just want information. But if, let's say you, Bob Cialdini, wanted to work, let's say, for UCSF, a major university medical center, and a certain department, and you knew the name of the man or woman who was the decision maker, what would Bob Cialdini do to get that 10 minutes or 15 minutes of FaceTime with that person to maximize the chances you might get the job?
Yeah, I mean, I think what an informational interview does is to say to the person on the other side of the table, hey, I'd like to take some of your time to get information. And so it's all for me,
mm-hmm.
right? But if instead you were to say, you know, I've spent some time on your website, I'm interested in the work that you do, and I wonder if you would allow me some time to suggest some insights that I've come to after looking at this from the following standpoint and on the basis of the following experience that I've had. Now you're offering them something.
Love it.
To make their time worthwhile to spend with you.
Caller, I'm going to leave you with that because our lines are lighted up, but I think that's gold. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco, Dr. Robert Cialdini. What's your question for him?
Hi, Marty. I'm actively pursuing a sales role, and I'm not really getting anywhere. I want to know if you have any advice on how I can get in the door better.
Do you want to take that, Rob, or do you want me to start with him?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, so you've been looking for a sales job. Give me the thumbnail summary of what you have done to try to land that job.
Well, you know, I'm on LinkedIn, Career Builder.
Very passive. Those are front door approaches where there are thousands, there's a herd of people trying to get in through the front door. Let me hear your 10-second pitch. Tell me why, if I were looking to hire a sales guy, why should I hire you?
Well, you know, everyone's going to say that they're going to work the hardest and they're going to, you know, go out and knock on the most doors.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not going to go that route.
Right.
What I'm going to bring to you is I'm going to bring my approach to life, which is become the very best at whatever it is you do.
It still sounds like blather. What if I said to you, this is the way you've got to sell not sizzle but steak. You need to say, even if you've never sold before, you can say, people have told me my whole life that I am excellent at selling. I could sell ice cubes to Eskimos, and I'd be pleased right now in this, for example, your product, you're selling, whatever, environmental control pollution devices. Let me take 60 seconds to explain how I would go about selling that. So you're showing, don't tell. That would be much more substantive. And, of course, if you have had sales experience, talking about how you have exceeded sales expectations while being ethical, it would seem to me you've got to show, don't tell, show with substance, not promises. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Okay, Robert Cialdini, what would you like to add to that?
Well, I'm not going to add anything to that. That sounds like a bullseye set of suggestions, Marty.
Okay.
I am going to have to go, however, I'm now running up against another conference call. So.
Okay, I want to thank you for the call. Do you want to take 3 minutes to answer, to provide the last of the six principles, or do you have to run?
Here's how I think it makes sense to wrap up, and that is okay. To say that I have a friend who is a marketing professor, and for the last 16 years, he's been trying to find the single most effective sales strategy, right? And I saw him at a conference, and he grabbed me by the elbow. He said, Bob, I found it. The single most effective sales strategy is not to have a single sales strategy. So the key, I think, is to examine every situation in terms of which of these principles is inherently there waiting to be engaged, not to go in with any one approach. The same approach in all situations is damned to be a failure. So our best strategy is to know these different tendencies inside all of us, and then where we see an opportunity to engage one that's naturally there in the situation, that's our best strategy.
And those indeed are all embodied in the classic book written by Dr. Robert Cialdini called Influence. And you can also learn more about speaking at your or consulting at your company on the art of influence at work at influenceatwork.com. Dr. Robert Cialdini, thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty
thank
Nemco.
You, Marty.
Okay,
so
be well.
Bye.
And what I want to do is I'm going to do two things. I'm going to go over those six principles for those of you who just joined us. And I will, those of you who have just called, stay on the line. We're going to take those calls. I will try to be, I am not Robert Cialdini, but I've also spent a little time trying to influence folks and helping my clients in the workspace to do that. So stay on the line. We're going to get to you in just a moment. The six principles, and I'll mention the sixth of them because it's the one we didn't get to talk about, and that is scarcity. Act now or your opportunity will soon be gone. We've all heard that. I actually know a winery owner who manufactures scarcity. He only releases a little of his, and it's $150 bottle wine. He only releases a very small amount of his $150 bottle wine. And he does that deliberately. He's got a ton of it in the warehouse. But he does it deliberately so it will sell out right away. And the store owners have to tell customers, oh, I'm sorry, this is out of stock. If we're lucky, we'll get more next week. So scarcity, real, making people feel it's like rare or you've got to act now, it's time delimited, is a core principle of influencing. Of course, the ethical way to do it is to not manufacture the scarcity, but to simply point it out if, in fact, it is real. So now I want to go over what these six principles are. These are the six principles of Robert Cialdini of influence. And I mentioned he really was maybe the key member of President Obama's 29-member, obviously highly influential and successful messaging team. And here are Cialdini's six principles. The first is reciprocity. If you do something for somebody, they feel obligated. As I said, in the workplace, obviously there are many gifts come. Companies give customers gifts. Workers give each other co-workers gifts, Christmas presents. It's not, your company didn't give you the Christmas bonus or even your salary because they're interested in being a charitable institution. They're doing it because if they give you money, if they give you that present, that they feel you will work harder, work smarter, do what you want for them, etc. If a boss picks you to go on that plum assignment to the training in Hawaii, they're doing that in hopes that you will not only learn from it, but will be indebted and loyal to the company. So reciprocity is a key principle for influence. The second principle is commitment. Getting somebody to buy into what you have said, if you can get them to buy in, it's usually easier to get them to buy into something small. So if you are in a private meeting asking them, you know, here is my thought, what do you think of this? And even, and you don't ask for the whole big, let's say you're wanting, really you want $100,000 for your new project. If you simply ask them, you know, I'd like to try a little pilot. It's only going to cost $500. Do you think we could try this little pilot? You're much more likely to get a yes and then get further along. Then you can say $10,000. That is one of President Obama's key strategies. For example, with healthcare, we know that he has early on, before he became president, he would love single payer. But he realized he can't get single payer healthcare. So he gets a commitment from the public for something much more modest, which is this current Obamacare. But it is only a part of the way to what he really wants. So getting commitment, a small commitment early, makes it easier to get a bigger commitment later. Three is social proof. Cialdini's principle, what I call, it's the bandwagon technique. If other people are doing it, especially if they're very similar to us, we're more likely to say, well, if they do it, you know, I'll do it. And this is a silly little thing, but if I've noticed that when people are at a stop sign, and they see everybody else coming to a full and complete stop, there's a tendency for those behind them to do it. If they see somebody in front of them coming to a rolling stop and not stopping, it's more likely that the person behind them will. There's this sense of social proof where other people are doing it. If other people are doing it, and that's going to be true again, if you in a meeting, in a work meeting, are making a presentation, if you point out the fact that others, let's say your competitive companies, are doing this process that you would like to, let's say you're trying to adopt a new form of diversity training, and you hear that your competitors are using that model of diversity training or that particular company, that's much more likely to get a yes than if you say it's just your idea. The fourth principle is liking. We're much more likely to do what someone wants if we like him or her, and we tend to like people who are similar to us in values and socioeconomic status and race and gender, etc. So while we can't, because of legal and also a current zeitgeist which says we must celebrate diversity, it's difficult to pull off. But if you can look for people you like as at least your initial point of entry, when you're trying to get something done at work, it seems obvious, but when you're trying to get something promulgated, go talk to someone first who shares your values. It doesn't have to be your race or your gender or any of that stuff, but somebody who really shares your values about it. But even frankly, and I really must say this, in the Bay Area, there tends to be, people tend, you know, when Madeleine Albright said, "Sis, there's a special place reserved in hell for women who don't help other women." There is a sisters help sisters, people of color help people of color mentality. So you may well want to, if you're trying to get something done in your workplace, going to somebody who you either share values with or race, gender, sexual orientation with, may be a better place to start the discussion. The fifth of his principles is authority. We all tend to, we say question authority, but we really tend to defer to it. So if you either in trying to promote something, you you cite an authority or you become the authority, you're going to be much more likely to get what you want done. And finally, as we said, scarcity, by pointing out, not manufacturing, but pointing out the scarcity of a particular, let's say, for example, as a job seeker. If you are doing a really thorough job search, you're going to be fortunate enough to have two or three companies or nonprofits or government agencies interested in you. You mention that it's you're scarce, essentially, because there's many people vying for your services. You're going to have far more success in getting the interest of an additional employer than if you say, I've been unemployed a long time, nobody's interested in hiring me. So point out that there is a scarcity of you and an excessive demand. Those are Robert Cialdini's six principles of influence that he used, of course, very successfully in leading President Obama's 29-member influencing team, but it can also help you in the workplace. And now I'd like to go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. What is your question or comment? Hi, it's you. Hi. Are you still there?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, sorry about that.
Okay, no problem. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to know what this scarcity, if it works with other things than luxury products, or how it would actually work, this notion of scarcity.
Well, let's take a simple little example. It has nothing to do with luxury products. If you, for example, are in a business that has low-priced products, you're working at Walmart, that's, if there's only one left of the product on the shelf, it's much more likely to sell than if it's stocked and overloaded with 50 of them. There is a scarcity. They say, oh, I better act now. And
talking about people, how does it relate to people finding a job?
Well, as I said, you know, if I said that there's 20 people who are interested in hiring me, I've gone and done a thorough job search and there were five or six other companies interested, then I am scarce. It's not easy to get me. It's not readily available. So by pointing out that there's other interest, and that's one of the main reasons I beg people to not do what they normally do, a drips and drabs job search. They get one lead that looks like it's maybe going to turn into a job. They stop their job search, and then they've only got that one lead. So they're not scarce. They're not in demand at all. I encourage people to take a short amount of time, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, to go and do everything possible to make as many connections and as many contacts as possible so that you maximize your chances that there are 2 or 3 or 4 entities interested in hiring you, and then you can tell that. When you get one job offer from somebody and then you say that there are, I am not really ready to accept your offer yet because there are 2 or 3 or 4 other entities that are interested, now you've got leverage. Now you've got power. Not only do they want to hire you, but they're more likely to respond to your request for a higher salary. Does that make sense? She's gone. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. We have just a little time left. I want to take one more call. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Are you talking to me?
I am.
Oh, my gosh. I was listening on the phone. I wanted to share with your person, Bob
Cialdini.
That I went to the Nissan introduction of the 2013 Nissan Leaf yesterday, and as
Nissan what?
Nissan Leaf.
Oh, the Leaf. Yeah, uh-huh. The all electric.
And you know, after being involved with this conversion car industry and culture for a long time, mm-hmm. and seeing all these ready-mades come on the market, it was astounding to all of us. There that Nissan said not just once or twice, but at least 5 times that I counted, if not more, because I got there late. Well, we took your idea, and this is another one of your ideas that you gave us that we've implemented in this new car. Mm-hmm. Totally powerful.
So you're saying you feel, did you feel grateful or did you feel ripped off?
Oh, no. It's like everybody gave advice. We all know what that's worth. And, you know, they've obviously taken feedback from the people that have done EV conversions, and they've implemented in their new design. And the horn still is a little quiet, but, mm-hmm. you know, it immediately makes me feel a little more positive towards
right.
the Leaf.
Everybody wants to feel heard. Everybody, that's why the most important principle of any business is talk to your customer, whether you're a nonprofit trying to get more funds, asking. The foremost potent, it was J.W. Marriott, who was the head of, started Marriott, who said the foremost potent words in the English language are, what do you think?
Well, I think listening and acting
right.
on it was even more powerful.
And on that note,
ask me what I think, and that's
yeah,
it.
Right. Anyway, thank you very much for the call. As again, I'm looking up at the clock. The show is over.
Today, Marty.
Thanks. I do my best. And then that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on calls. And Randy Tillery and Mark Martin are experts on the new little boom in manufacturing jobs and training for them in the Bay Area. It's something we think that was dead, all manufacturing in China. Not true. There's at least a little blip right here in the Bay Area. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.